Look at you. Headphones in, totally relaxed, holiday mode has been fully engaged, and you haven't even reached the airport yet.
We are now arriving at Gatwick Airport. Thank you for travelling with Gatwick Express.
Glide to Gatwick from London Victoria in half an hour on your all-new Gatwick Express. Save 10% on easy barcode tickets straight to your inbox and breeze through the barriers. Book now at gatwickexpress.com.
No risk it, no biscuit.
Coming from the Arizona desert, presented by SBNation.com. For Arizona Cardinals fans, by Arizona Cardinals fans, with outsider and insider's perspectives, this is Revenge of the Birds.
Hello, Arizona Cardinals fans. I'm Jess Root. This is Revenge of the Birds. Thank you, as always, for listening. As this is a show that we're talking, it's not literally the happy show, not nearly as happy a situation as the Arizona Cardinals did not extend their winning streak, and they went to Seattle and did not come away with a victory. But today we're going to talk about, we're going to review week 12. This is your week 12 review show, Arizona Cardinals news and commentary through Revenge of the Birds Radio. I'm your host, Jess Root, again, and this show is brought to you by Audible.com. Audible.com, which is the internet's leading source of audio content, whether it be podcasts, audiobooks, or whatever you're looking for. Audible.com is the place to go. It is the service for you. And we are offering a free trial for Revenge of the Birds Radio's listeners. Visit audibletrial.com/Revenge of the Birds. That's audibletrial.com/Revenge of the Birds. And you get yourself to try out, get a test run of the service for a free month and a free audiobook download. Again, that's audibletrial.com/Revenge of the Birds. Here, Cardinals fans, we've got a lot to talk to you about with the loss to the Seattle Seahawks. Kind of recap what happened in the last several days. Last week, Seth Cox and I were on. We talked about the victory that the Cardinals had last weekend, well, 2 weekends ago. And then towards the end of the week, Danny Kelly from fieldgoals.com was a guest of mine as we previewed the matchup. Unfortunately, entering the game, Larry Fitzgerald was not able to play on Sunday. His sprained knee kept him from being able to run. He'd give it a try, and Bruce Arians revealed after the game that Larry was unable to even run. So the Cardinals went without Larry Fitzgerald. They were playing with their backup quarterback in Drew Stanton. And it started out not looking good, and it continued to not look great, although the defense played fantastically. In the end, it was a 19-3 loss to the defending champ Seattle Seahawks. And we'll talk about the good and the bad from that game. But basically, it was an offensive struggle all game. And there were some bright spots, but they come home. They come back to Arizona for the week of practice. Now 9-2 on the season. And what's more, almost everyone in the division, but the Seattle Seahawks, they gained a game on the Cardinals. The San Francisco 49ers won. They gained a game on the Cardinals. And the Green Bay Packers also won on Sunday, gaining a game on the Cardinals as well. So moving forward, what we're going to be talking about today, I've got Seth Cox on the line. I'm going to bring him on live in just a moment as we're getting ready to talk about what we're going to talk about tonight, which includes the Cardinals actually made a roster move Tuesday. We're recording live Tuesday nights. If you're listening to us live, thank you. And if you have any comments, questions, or whatnot, if you would like to give us a call, that number is 646-478-3787. That's 646-478-3787. And the Arizona Cardinals, they added a running back today. Obviously, the running game has not been superb, to say the least. They added veteran Michael Bush, 6'1", 245-pound running back who last played for the Chicago Bears after a few seasons with the Oakland Raiders. He joins the team today. The team announced on Tuesday. And they cut running back Kerwin Williams, who was added to the practice squad earlier this season from the Colts, a guy that Bruce Arians knew from his time there. Likewise, and Kerwin Williams, he might be brought back on the practice squad, but he was needed to let go. He was thrown to the roster when Stephon Taylor went down on an injury, and they were down to Andre Ellington and Marion Grice and Robert Hughes, and then they brought up Williams as an insurance policy. But let's go ahead and get started. We're going to talk about we're going to lead with the move to sign Michael Bush, what that means to the offense and to the running game overall. We're going to look back at that game in Seattle. Hopefully we won't dwell on everything, but at least from my perspective, the sky is not falling yet. There are definite concerns. And we're going to talk about they're talking about the playoff hopes moving forward, the outlook, where the Cardinals stand in terms of postseason play. And then we're going to look ahead to the Atlanta Falcons. I will let you know that there will be no preview show this week, later this week, being with the holiday season and all Thanksgiving coming up. Dave Choate from the Falcoholic.com, our SB Nation blog for the Falcons, he will be out of town for the holidays. So this will be the last show, the only show of the week until we come back next week. So let's bring on Seth. Seth, how are you doing tonight? How's everything going?
Good, Jess. How are you?
Doing fantastic. Tell us, for you, was the sky falling on Sunday? It felt like on Sunday that, at least on Twitter, that things were not so great.
No, it was just one of those games. You know, me being me, I was the only person in the pick'em poll to pick the Cardinals to lose that game. This was one of those games that you kind of, even as the Cardinals playing earlier in the year with as healthy as they've been team, and with Palmer and Fitz and all those guys, this is just one of those games that is a tough one to project as a win anyway. And then you add into the fact the desperation factor of the Seahawks, and it just was a recipe for the loss that we saw. So while I think it was more disappointing in the way they lost than that they lost, it's just one of those things that you don't want to say you expected, but you saw coming, and you're not okay with, but you understand you understand it in the scope of everything.
And the truth is, I'm kind of the same boat with you. Now, I'll tell you, leading up to that game on Sunday, I was very much as the week went on, I was like, I'm not afraid of this of Seahawks. I'm not afraid of this. I understood they're a tough team, but the way the Cardinals have been playing, I really didn't fear them at all heading to the game. Now, granted, I was under the assumption that Larry Fitzgerald would probably give it a go and would probably play. And so there were a whole bunch of things that just didn't go the Cardinals' way. Fitzgerald couldn't play. Drew Stanton didn't look particularly fantastic. And it's kind of like what you said. I could live with the loss. I would understand it. I didn't like how I lost. And we'll talk about that a little bit more. But let's go ahead and get started. Talk about the move to sign Michael Bush. An interesting move considering the situation running back. And it seemed like they were just going to ride Andre Ellington as far as they could go. What are your initial reactions to the addition of the veteran? And granted, this is a big guy. I was comparing measurables. Bush 6'1", 245, that compared to Stephon Taylor, 5'9", 214. Or even take Jonathan Dwyer, who was with the team earlier, was considered a bigger back. He was 5'11", 225. So he's got, you know, you've got 2 inches and 20 pounds more. And even Robert Hughes, who is the fullback, was a big guy himself. He's 5'11", 235. And so you're adding you're getting 6'1", 245. Michael Bush is quite a big guy. What were your initial reactions, and what is your take as to what this signing means?
I was a little bit surprised that it was Bush. When you look at just kind of names that have been out there all year, he's been out there, and I understand they wanted to give, Taylor a look, and it seems kind of like Grice is, nowhere to be found at this point and all of that. But if that was what you were thinking, or if that's what you're going to do, why not do it earlier? And in the same vein, I would have preferred somebody different, somebody that in their last full season of play did not average 3.1 yards per carry in the NFL. Now, this isn't to say that he's just going to come in and, you know, be the guy he was in Chicago the last 3 years, but he's not coming into a situation where there's exactly a strong run-blocking offensive line in play already. So, you know, in terms of getting, and I text you this after the news came, in terms of getting a different style back, I think that's a success. And they found somebody that's probably better than Stephon Taylor as a runner. So realistically, there's nothing bad here. It just seems like there wasn't as big of an upgrade as I think we're all hoping that there will be.
Now, tell me one thing. I not seen a lot of Michael Bush. Interestingly, interesting story. It was brought to my memory as I was writing up the story this evening. I didn't get to it till this evening, but I recall 2 years ago, I was sitting at a spring training game, working a spring training game in 2012, covering the Diamondbacks in spring training. And previous to the game, I got an email or a tweet or something from someone. It was a source that told me, hey, Michael Bush of the Raiders, formerly of the Raiders, was on a plane headed to Arizona. He's going to be working out with the Cardinals. Okay. Nothing else come of it. There was the report came out. Michael Bush was reportedly going to visit with the Cardinals back in March of 2012. Turns out, at least it, that's what came out publicly. He was out there just to catch a football game. Some of the local reporters, they never saw him come into the facility. So that never, you know, never really happened. But it's interesting that 2 years later, with a different coaching staff, different general manager, they end up landing Bush. But outside of his running ability, what's kind of the scouting reports that you know of him when in terms of pass blocking and pass catching?
He's pretty good in the backfield, and I mean he was previously. Again, his skills diminished while he was in Chicago from the time he left Oakland and started in Chicago until recently last year. So there's that. In terms of as a runner, he's a power guy between the tackles. He's not going to burn anybody or burn by anybody, but you know, he's a good back out of the backfield, good pass blocker. You wonder how much that has to do with their unhappiness with Taylor's ability in the backfield and pass catching and pass blocking situations, or Hughes for that matter. I know they used him a couple times, so more so than maybe as a change of pace runner, because again, something we talked about almost 2 years ago now when they brought in Bruce Arians was the fact that Bruce Arians is not really a split carries guy. He's a 70-30 type of guy, even 80-20 if he can be. And you know, that's what he was with Mendenhall when Mendenhall was healthy, and we were all clamoring for more carries from Ellington, and that's kind of what it's been with Ellington this year. So I'm not sure what it means in terms of running. I know he offers a completely different style than anything they have right now. So at least there's that. But he is a good a pass catcher, and he was decent as a pass protector. We'll see if he still has those skills, or if his play in Chicago was indicative of why he had not been signed by any NFL teams so far this year.
Well, and for me, you know, Arians was on SiriusXM NFL with Alex Marvez, Bill Pullen. He was on that. He has his spot on that radio show every Tuesday, and he talked about Michael Bush. What he said on the air is, "We need a guy who's going to pound it in there and close out games for us." That tells me a couple of things. That I think that they have kind of pulled back suddenly on the whole Andre Ellington being all everything, seeing that his production, well, due to whatever, well, whether it's injury or ineffectiveness, is, you know, I think they finally saw, maybe Andre's not the guy to be able to do it for us if he's by himself. And truthfully, I think you could probably agree that coming into this season, they didn't actually see him being carrying the workload that he did, because they had planned on Jonathan Dwyer being that change of pace guy. And really, what I thought all the time coming into this season is that we would see Ellington used like the way he was used the second half of the season, which was really fantastic, truthfully. We just see it a couple more carries, but a little bit more in playing time. Do you think perhaps that, assuming he gets acclimated to the offense right away, that he's going to be that guy that Dwyer, instead of you know, the 5 to 10 snaps that Stephon Taylor's been getting, or the 5 snaps that Marion Grice is getting, that we're going to see Bush in there for, say, 20 snaps, bringing, you know, keeping Ellington's right at about 40-ish.
Yeah, I think that's the goal. But of course, I mean, he has to still have something left, and that's always the concern. Again, I mean, you kind of go back and look at his career numbers. I have them right here. Hold on. Where did I put them? And his yards per carry has diminished every year since he left
after
Oakland.
His second,
I mean, he was at 4.1, and then he was at 3.8, and then 3.6, and then, like I said, last year he was at 3.1. So you
but he barely, I mean, he barely saw the ball last year. In 15 games, he had 63 carries. So you're getting,
yeah,
what, 4 carries a game?
That, I think that 2012 season is kind of more indicative of what he is now, where you saw him, you know, get about 114 carries, and then he caught 9 passes. I mean, it's going to be, I think, and I would have to go back and look at the numbers, but I think what their goal is to get 15 carries to Ellington. You know, if he's running well, then you let him keep going. But I think their goal is to get 15 carries for Ellington, you know, 10 carries for Bush, and the person initially for that was Dwyer. And then, you know, getting Ellington another 5 to 7 touches in the passing game. And that'll be your, you know, and that's something that you and I had talked about at the beginning of the season. And it kind of seemed like what they were doing at the beginning of the season, and then obviously the Dwyer incident, and kind of everything fell apart from that situation. So you look at it, and I think they would like Bush to be that person, but I think that they also would have liked Taylor or Grice or somebody to kind of grab that position. So what it ends up being is, and it's never necessarily bad desperation, but it just is desperation on looking for somebody that can fill the void that you've had on your roster since week, what was that, 2 or 3? I think he was suspended after week 2. So, you know, that's kind of, well, not suspended, but whatever the wording is, what he is. You know, I think that's what the goal is. I think the goal is to find somebody that can do 10 carries a game, and it's not, you know, for 25 yards. And
even if it's the 3.1, I mean, honestly, that's about what they were getting anyway, because Andre Ellington in almost 200 carries is averaging 3 and a 3.3. Stephon Taylor in his 25 carries is averaging 3.3. If they can average 3.5, if he can put up Rashard Mendenhall production, guess what? That's a win. That's absolutely a win. And it goes back to the conversation that I heard, we talked about earlier in the year, but the conversation I had in the press box with some of the local media guys is, you know, you look at the running game, you see it's a very understated effect how much they miss Jonathan Dwyer. Interesting fact, and I actually Kent Hoder brought it up to me because I actually didn't know that these stats were already broken down somewhere. So on ESPN's team statistics, it kind of breaks things down. And something very interesting, and I think I can see in my mind how the Cardinals will use Dwyer, and I think it's how they will be effective, is the Cardinals have been terrible, this just absolutely dreadful at running the ball in tight formations. Like last in, against Seattle, they went with a three tight end set. On the season, they're averaging like 2.5 yards per carry. Now, I think that those numbers include everything. So that includes kneel downs, which are those jumbo formations. So I pulled out all the kneel downs, but with between two tight end sets and three tight end sets, the Cardinals are averaging in both. I think it's 2.6 or 2.8 with two tight ends in the game. And with three tight ends in the game, taking out all those kneel downs by the quarterbacks, so there are like the 13 of them over the course of the season, they average 2.9, just under 3 yards a carry with three tight ends in the game. They go to one tight end, no tight ends. The running game is so much more effective. But that just tells you the type of runner that Andre Ellington is. He's not a guy that's a best fit for those tight formations. And if you spread things out, that's where he can be used. Ideally, if I say, okay, we've got now Michael Bush and Andre Ellington. If I were to draw up and say, in Madden per se, and if I were to build my depth chart, I would have Ellington in every 11. And every one tight end and no tight end, unless you're going straight passing. And then for anything two and three, that's when you bring in Bush, which is almost how they used Dwyer almost early in the season. But I would love to see that because Bush is definitely going to be the much better runner inside the tackles in a tight formation against a bunch of guys in the box. While Ellington, you give him space and he can make things happen.
Well, and part of the problem is a lot of their guys are not successful running those zone plays, those inside zone plays. You know, it was interesting. I went back and I read my scouting report on what I wrote about Ellington on that long write-up I did on Ellington at Revenge of the Birds last year after they drafted him. And I took some slack during the season because I talked about how Ellington's not a creative runner in terms of making plays, making things out of nothing. He's a guy that is really good at following his blocks and, you know, kind of going where the play is designed to go, but he's not a guy that's going to get super creative and, you know, kind of obviously not ever going to be this good, but going to be like Barry Sanders and, you know, make something out of nothing when it's not there. And I think that we're seeing that more this year when he's been asked to be a guy that runs inside, a guy that does, you know, runs inside zones, inside powers. When you see, you know, when they're not doing the zone stretch, which is kind of his bread and butter, or something to the outside in terms of a power sweep or something like that, you're seeing where he's struggling to find the cutback lanes. He's struggling to make a play going, you know, east and west before he gets going north and south. So I think in terms of Bush, you're exactly right. He's a guy that's probably a little more adept at running that inside zone with a little more success. So we'll see, you know, again, the question is how soon can it happen? Because as we'll get to before the show ends, you're going up against another team that's really not good against the run. You know, like Seattle was not in their one game without Brandon Kneebane. And now, but you're also going up against a team that's kind of got their backs against the wall in terms of playoffs and is probably pretty desperate. So it'll be interesting to see if Bush is ready to go or if it's still going to be the Taylor and hope that Ellington doesn't get hurt kind of committee back there.
And I think in the I think the one thing we can be sure of is that Stephon Taylor, his playing time will have almost disappeared. I think we will see him in the Alphonso Smith role of a season ago, where his job is to come in and pass block once in a while, and that's about it.
Well, that's why I was always interested why they cut Alphonso, because I thought Alphonso was their best passer last year. So that was just as an aside.
All right. Well, let's move on from Michael Bush. Obviously, there was a football game that the Cardinals played on Sunday. It wasn't a particularly fun one to watch. It was actually very as you're watching it, because you know what the type of team the Cardinals have been all year, there was always a little bit of hope. However, if you watch that game, you're thinking, oh, my heavens. Offensively, it was so hard. It just seemed like first downs of any sort doing anything offensively was just an impassable mountain. And that's what it felt like early on. And they felt towards the end of the half when they got the field goal, you're like, okay, they're going to get started, things going, things. And it never happened. It just never really happened offensively. So let's talk a little bit about the good and the bad. Let's start with the bad, because let's get that out of the way. Talk about the bad from the game. What was the bad? What are the concerns in particular that you had from the Seattle game?
I think the first thing that comes in terms of bad, because we knew the run was going to be a struggle still, the first thing that came from the bad was the lack of efficiency and ability in the passing game. Michael Floyd was non-existent again. I really feel like John Brown's moved into that number two receiver role at this point. And the Carlson, I think, had the one nice catch, I believe it was, but it just seemed like there was no windows for Stanton to throw in. And then when there were windows, he either missed or somebody dropped the ball. So it just felt like there was never a rhythm in the passing game, which is concerning because, as you and I have talked about before, that was kind of supposed to be the plan. Was Fitzgerald was supposed to be the one that was kind of phased out. And now, you kind of get him in a game where he's not in, and you see just how bad your passing game looked without him. And now at least it made me sit back and go, is that going to be the best decision to make going forward? So I think that was the biggest thing, is that pass protection wasn't terrible. It wasn't as good as it had been before, especially the week before. But the fact that the passing game was so inept was troubling.
And, yes, a couple of things that stood out to me. One is, maybe this is my knee-jerk reaction, but it's over the past several weeks you're thinking, I was so wrong about Michael Floyd, because it was about this time a season ago when he had those three or four games right in a row. And I said on this show that we're seeing Michael Floyd as the best receiver on the Arizona Cardinals. And oh my heavens, was I so wrong. I don't know what it is about this season. He had the one really fantastic game. But like last year, he's had so many games where he just seems invisible. And whether it's, he got dinged up a little bit. And whether it's something he's doing in practice, they're just not finding, or Arians just not knowing how to deal with that type of receiver out in the field as opposed to his toy in John Brown. He's just not been an impactful player almost at all this year, which is disappointing. He's turned into... basically, he's a one-trick pony. If you let him high point the ball, he's going to go get it for you. If he gets a little bit of separation deep, you can get them the ball. But he's not really – you're not getting the ball underneath. And when we saw him, he could become another Anquan Boldin. Anquan Boldin, you found all sorts of ways to get him the ball. Michael Floyd's not doing that. Another takeaway is outside of just the Cardinals did about everything wrong that you could possibly do. They had penalties when big plays were happening. They were bad on special teams. They turned the ball over. They had a punt block for, they didn't even have enough players on the field. And it's just everything that could go wrong did. And then on top of that, you were without Larry Fitzgerald. And I think we saw what our worst case scenario is for Drew Stanton as a quarterback. And this is where you say, Drew Stanton needs home. I'll say this. He wasn't terrible against Denver, but he wasn't great. He wasn't even great against New York, and it took a Ted Ginn punt return to save the Bacon team to get that win. But Stanton's been really two very different quarterbacks at University of Phoenix Stadium and away from University of Phoenix Stadium. And which is, this you're talking about, okay, he's a classic back quarterback. But it kind of underscores the super importance of finishing strongly enough, scratching out enough wins to get that home field advantage so that you don't have to lean on Stanton. I'm going to describe it this way. Stanton can be a solid quarterback if you got players around him making plays. He doesn't seem to be a quarter, and this is kind of going for it. He's not a quarter that we've seen that makes this for his teammates. Like he's not going to make his receivers better. His receivers can make him look good, but unlike Carson Palmer, who can then put his receivers in the right situation and get them in situations and give them throws that make them look better, is that dreaded game manager, where when you're playing him at quarterback against as dominating as it is, the defending champs on the road, when you're not at full strength, Stanton's not the guy. And those are kind of the biggest concerns I had is it underscored, I said it, there's a definite drop off from Palmer to Stanton. You really saw it. I mean, the Cardinals, even with Carson Palmer, threw four interceptions a season ago and still managed to get that win, because what did Palmer do? He made a big time throw in the game. Stanton, you really haven't kind of seen that yet, except for at the beginning of the game. Except when he first came in, when there's the adrenaline rush against the Rams, you saw it to start against the Lions, but that was still in the scripted plays. So what we haven't seen for him to do is to go make plays for his teammates.
Yeah, and we're seven quarters without a touchdown. So it's becoming, it is an issue. As much as people want to be like, oh, don't panic, 9-2, 9-2. It's not necessarily panic. It's just a reality that you've gone, whatever it is, 105 game minutes without scoring a touchdown. And I know that Jerron Brown dropped a pass, but those things happen in games. You have to be able to answer on the next play or the next series or, whatever, the next quarter, whatever it is, you have to come back and answer. And as you kind of alluded to, and I'll say it in a more blunt way, if things aren't set up perfectly, it feels like there's an air of this isn't going to work out around your standing. That, all right, we're going to be in for a long day. And that's kind of how it's been for Stanton in his good games and his bad games. So that's what the question is can the Cardinals figure out a way to keep him in consistent situations where he's not asked to necessarily make plays, but he's able to allow others to make plays? There's always a conversation. We go back to the draft last year and AJ McCarron, and the question was, is he an elevator of talent or is he being elevated by the talent around him? And I think in two games so far, we've seen that Drew Stanton is not an elevator, but he's somebody that's elevated. So that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's not saying, the season's over, just close up shop. But it is saying that you have to you have to play a nearly perfect game if you're going to beat good teams. We saw it against Detroit even. I mean, Detroit's offense is terrible, and their defense allowed a couple big plays, and that opened up things for the Cardinals because the rest of the game, the Cardinals were shut down. So in the same vein, you look at the Seahawks, the Cardinals didn't make those big plays, and they even allowed big plays to happen against them, and then it ends up being a case where he's not a guy that's going to, at least he hasn't shown that he's a guy that you feel comfortable coming back from a 2-touchdown deficit. You know, you want the game to be in control and him not having to throw the ball all over the field.
And with Stanton, it's, and I don't know if it'll matter if Carson Palmer is there, because you look at the way that Seattle was playing defense. They were playing very well. They bottled up the running game. They were covering well. And as a result, I mean, Stanton had nowhere to go with the ball. But I'm going to take the level of concern back down, because it sounds like, oh my gosh, the feeling we're starting to get our listeners is that the sky is falling. I don't think the sky is falling. There is definite concern. But if you look at least on the road, when you're on the road with Drew Stanton, if you look at the Giants game, they got a good effort from their defense. It wasn't superb. It was a good effort, and they had plays on special teams. And against Seattle, special teams failed. They had the punt block. They missed a field goal. They did get the field goal block, so that there was that. But you didn't have that. The return game was no good. Not necessarily blaming Ted Ginn for that. Their return games, the kick blocking, the blocking for kickoff returns has just been horrendous this year. So they're not making plays on offense, and it's not only that, they're playing bad on special teams. They're playing bad on offense. You're never going to beat a desperate team on the road, especially one who are the defending the champs on the road with your backups, if you're playing badly on offense and badly on special teams. You can win with a great defensive effort if in at least one of those other two phases of the games that you get an okay effort. And kind of like what you saw last year when they beat the Seahawks in Seattle in week 16, there's that shot. But when you play badly in two of the three phases of the game, you're going to lose the game. Which for me, it kind of goes down to that. You can't expect Carson Palmer. You can't even really expect Tom Brady or Peyton Manning to overcome not even average performances in the other two phases of the game.
No, and I think that's what the reality is, that we're coming to a realization that if this team isn't consistently moving the ball forward, and Drew Butler's really hurt this team the last, you know, at least in the Seattle game, but if they're not able to control field position and create turnovers on defense, this offense hasn't shown the capability, even with Carson Palmer, they haven't shown the capability of being a team that's going to consistently go down the field and score points. So, like you said, you know that's your offense already. Now you're struggling on special teams to flip field position because, like you said, Drew Butler struggled. The return game was getting nothing done. Basically what happened was, outside of Russell Wilson playing extremely well, the Seahawks beat you at your own game. The Seahawks didn't run the ball well at all. I mean, the Cardinals shut down the Seahawks running game.
Outside of Wilson, who would dad gump Russell Wilson.
Yeah. But outside of Russell Wilson, the Cardinals were able to, you know, shut down the other phases of the Seahawks offense, but they had one person making plays. I'm not even sure, like you said, if Carson Palmer in that game scenario is able to make plays, but we've seen him be able to control the tempo of the game, if you will. I don't know why, and maybe it's just me, but I feel like when Drew Stanton's playing, there's a lot of frenetic energy out there. So it feels just like there's a slight difference in the way everybody's, you know, playing in the game. But it was just one of those performances, like you said, by Seattle, kind of like Arizona last year in Seattle, where no matter what the Seahawks did, they weren't going to beat the Cardinals, because the Cardinals, that was one of those games where the Cardinals had to have it. Their backs were up against the wall, even though it was on the road, and even overcoming a putrid performance by their offense, they still made a play when it mattered. But the difference this week was Seattle was in the role of Arizona, and it was just kind of the same thing.
Oh, and the one big thing last year that they were able to do is they were able to run the ball. I mean, Arizona managed, you know, 64 yards rushing. 64. That's a fantastic, fantastically bad number of rushing yards when they had more than twice that a season ago, which allowed them to stay in the game. So they were at least moving the ball. They were just turning the ball over. So they were moving the ball okay last year and just turn it over and then made the big play. They just weren't doing anything. They couldn't run the ball. Although, yeah, just, they were getting nothing out of the running game. Now, defensively, let's look at this. They held the Seahawks at 293 yards total offense. That's it. Total offense. 124 of those came on the ground. And so it was, if you look at the number of yards they gave up the ground, it wasn't great. But over 70 of those came from just Russell Wilson. And he's so hard to defend when it comes to running, because he's so talented at it. But that's one thing you have to really, and so let's kind of change gears towards the good. You have to really, really be encouraged, because heading into that game, when it comes to stopping the run, at least stopping running backs, which is going to be the case for most teams, with almost all the teams, is Marshawn Lynch, that their rushing offense, that number one rushing offense that Seattle had with Marshawn Lynch, that was the true test. Were they just fortunate with how the other team's game planning? No. They stuffed Marshawn Lynch and held him to, you know, 39 yards on 15 carries. That their run defense is legitimate. Scrambling quarterbacks will give them trouble when they break away from plays. That's going to be the issue. But their rush defense is amazing.
Yeah, and I was actually really encouraged with their pass defense as well. You know, they had the one miscommunication between Rashad and Patrick that led to the...
And that was a fantastic play by Russell Wilson, who deked Johnson to go back to the other side of the field to get his guy open. So that was a fantastic play by Wilson. And then there was the one play, the touchdown to Helfit. And you really, looking at the play, aside from tackling, there really wasn't anyone you could blame for the coverage, because it was a really good play design.
Yeah, no, it was just terrible tackling at the end. And, you know, that's something that we've seen a little bit on the back end.
Rashad Johnson.
from game to game. You know, even Buchanan has struggled a little bit in wrapping up and tackling. He's missing tackles too. So it's been, you know, it's been one of those things. But, yeah, I think defensively you're excited about the fact that you're seeing a consistent pass rush. And I think we said it the last couple of weeks, as good as Alex Okafor is playing statistically, I think Calais Campbell is the complete reason as to why this pass rush has come alive. Because all of a sudden now they're able to basically, Alex Okafor is a guy that can win enough times in one-on-one blocking situations, that he can take advantage of the fact that Calais gets double teamed a lot. Whereas, you know, Sam Acho is not somebody that can do that. They've brought Lorenzo Alexander on the field, in fact, instead of Acho at times on third downs in passing situations. So I think you're looking at a situation where they're finding their kind of groove in terms of personnel. It's sad that Kareem Martin hasn't, you know, been able to help out more as you and I were hoping and expecting at the beginning of the season. But you have a very talented group up front with interior pressure coming from Calais, Tommy Kelly, Frosty Rucker, and then Alex Okafor's done a really nice job in one-on-one situations. And for some reason, being unblocked a lot against Seattle. I don't know if that was a plan or what, but there was just, I think I counted six times that he came off the edge without being touched by anybody. And that's just an interesting way to attack somebody, I guess, especially somebody that's as disciplined as Okafor has been so far. So I thought it was a, I thought it was a great performance from the defense. And, you know, they were working on a lot of short fields. So they,
That was just insane. The fact that they were able to keep it so close for so long. I mean, the touchdown really broke their back.
Go ahead. Wasn't even that the touchdown broke their back as much as it was that they just put the game so far out of reach with the way the offense was playing that, yeah, it broke their back, but it was more of a, oh my goodness. Like, no matter what unless we're scoring a touchdown now, there's nothing that we can do because the offense has been, you know, so bad this day. So, yeah, it was just interesting. I was really impressed with how the defense played, and I was happy to see the continued dominance in terms of especially the run defense, but also the pass rush that continued to make plays. But that highlighted something you and I talked about last week. There are certain quarterbacks that you don't want to face in the playoffs. And I think Russell Wilson might be on that list. I don't know. I don't know how you feel, but I think he might end up being on that list as well.
It's for different reasons too. And for me, Russell Wilson, because he's a very disciplined player, he's very good about making good decisions. Aaron Rodgers, Peyton Manning, those type of guys, Tom Brady. I worry about them because, especially when the Cardinals weren't getting much of a pass rush, is because they can pick apart even a good secondary. They can do that. Russell Wilson makes you pay other ways because you can have good coverage down the field, but if you get good pressure, you can even get a good pressure on him. But if you move him off his spot and don't clean up, that's the thing. They had seven sacks in that game. They sacked Russell Wilson seven times, and you'd think that you'd be great with that. But what was Bruce Arians talk about? The four or five other times they should have sacked him, and those four or five other times when they didn't sack him, they turned into big plays. Because he's the type of guy, even if you get him off his spot, guess what? He's going to make a play down the field, whether it's with his legs or with his arm.
Yeah, and so he just kind of falls into that same category for me right now, is just a guy that you probably don't want to see in January with a possible trip to the NFC Championship game or Super Bowl on the line.
Although Russell Wilson is a much different quarterback on the road than at home. And if you look at just like the record, he's only lost twice at home in his career, but he's barely above 500 on the road. I mean, barely above 500. So it's a case where if you can face him at University of Phoenix Stadium, you like your chances. I mean, we're going to get to see him later this year, so we get to see that once again. What else? What were some other good takeaways from anything good that we can look at outside of, hey, the pass rush, if that's had. Now, by the way, that pass rush, but we are so concerned about 8 sacks in 8 games. In 3 games, they now have 17. Alex Okafor now piling up the sacks. Dan Buchanan now has a couple sacks. I mean, Calais Campbell, now I'll point this out. Calais Campbell, 8, because he was feeding on a backup, which is exactly what you want to see from a star player like that. When you get a backup on the offensive line, this is what happened with Darnell Dockett a season ago. Whoa, half his sacks or three of his four or five sacks came against, you know, undrafted rookies playing at the offensive line. But that's exactly when you're a dominant player and you get someone who's not good, they need to dominate that match. And that's exactly what Calais Campbell did. So it was great to see.
Yeah, and I, you know, to go to the other side of the ball and what was good, I thought Jared Valdir played a good game in pass protection. I thought Ted Larson was actually not bad. Obviously, the struggles in the run game for everybody were obvious. So, but I think in pass protection, you had to have been happy with Valdir. Larson, on a second viewing, without a bunch of people around, I noticed that he played better. Send line and the center to the right side was just a bad game for everybody. Kind of one of those that you just throw out the window. I know that we've talked about the interior a lot recently, but it's just one of those games where you just, everybody was so bad that it's hard to kind of well on anybody. And I thought the fact that Jonathan Cooper played 6 plays and, you know, did a nice job on those 6 plays. I believe they ran behind him all 6 plays. So he, you know, he kind of showed what we were hoping he would show. So we'll see if maybe that leads to something else. You know, not even in terms of replacing like a Larson or a Fanica, but just in terms of maybe this will place, you know, put the more emphasis on maybe he can be not even a fullback, but, you know, an extra tight end, extra tackle, things like that in the running game, because he did play well in my mind.
And an interesting thing, what happens the second that we lose? And this is one of the things I said during this, like when the Cardinals drafted Troy Nicholas, and because we saw last season, they used Bobby Massey as a tackle eligible. And they used Bradley Sowell early in the year as a jumbo, as that third tight end for jumbo packages. When they went out and drafted Troy Nicholas, they said, oh, that the big thing that we're going to see is that we won't see those that extra lineman in anymore. So you add an extra dimension because you had Troy Nicholas in there into the blocking and you get the possibility of throwing the ball to him. Guess what? The second Troy Nicholas gets hurt, what do they do with their jumbo? They, instead of using, you know, Darren Fells, John Carlson, and Rob Hausler, they drop one of the tight ends and they bring in an offensive lineman that happens to be Cooper. So it's kind of played out exactly that way. And it's really a shame that Nicholas went down. But it's good to get Cooper on the field to do something. Now, yes, he is on field goal teams now, so he's on the line for field goals, and then now he is the jumbo tight end. I think that if you look at the individual performances that Jerron Brown, outside of that drop, he looked pretty solid. But, yeah, again, you're going to see it was kind of emphasized the fact, wow, okay, they will miss Larry. That's something to talk about. That they will miss Larry. I think it's kind of clear at this point that he means a lot more to this offense than we thought he meant to the offense coming into this season. Well, let's turn their view towards the future, to the playoffs now, to talk a little bit about the situation where the Cardinals stand at 9-2. They are still the number one seed. They still hold. If, for example, you know, if Green Bay were able to catch them, and Green Bay has basically one tough game and a bunch of cupcakes after that. Cardinals have a pretty tough schedule. They sit atop the NFC with the number one seed, 9-2. Green Bay at 8-3 is the number two seed, followed by Philadelphia Eagles at 8-3 atop the NFC East. And fantastic. The 4-7 Atlanta Falcons, the number 4. 2 wild card spots are held by the Detroit Lions and the San Francisco 49ers. I'm sorry, not the San Francisco 49ers, but the Seattle Seahawks. Both the Seahawks and the 49ers are two games back of the Cardinals, both at 7-4, Cardinals 9-2. And with the loss to Seattle, or at least right now, Seattle would hold a tiebreak over them in virtue of that head-to-head win. But the Cardinals really still are in control of things. And a win this weekend will go a long way, because even if Green Bay wins this weekend, if they're a game behind the Cardinals, and the Cardinals win in Atlanta, that almost makes it impossible for Green Bay to jump over Arizona in terms of record, because they would have to actually outwin them completely by record because of the conference tiebreaker. Since they don't play the Packers this year, they would go based on the NFC record. And Arizona's already 7-1. A win over Atlanta makes it 8-1. And what is it right now? I did the playoff picture this morning. What is Green Bay's record in the conference? Waiting. Open that up. Green Bay, and I think they're 5-3 in the conference, 6-3 in the NFC. So Arizona, if after this weekend, would improve to 8-1. So they'd be two games up in the conference against Green Bay. And even if Green Bay wins, so over the last four games, they would have to overtake the Cardinals outright, finishing one game better, because even at a tie, the Cardinals would still hold on top, which is going to be really tough to do. I kind of like that situation. What do you look if you're looking at the playoff picture moving forward? Do you still see the Cardinals as being in the driver's seat, or still have kind of the inside track to the number one seed?
I think with the way their schedule is set up here to end the season, you have a game against Atlanta this week where you look at desperate team that needs a win, and then you have a game against Kansas City the next week that all of a sudden has a different kind of mentality of what they're playing for with the Eric Berry news today. And so I have thought all along, even with those circumstances, those are their two most winnable. And it's not that the other games are not winnable, but those are the games you feel the most comfortable with.
And that they should win. They should win those.
Out of the last five. And you look at those, and I think that's an important two games now, because that 11 number is going to be big in terms of, you get to 11, that means
with three games left.
Yeah, that means that Seattle can only lose once, because then in theory, if you finish 11-5, just say Seattle ends up with a tiebreaker because of head-to-head. But you want to get to that 11, because then that puts pressure on Seattle to only be able to lose once, and San Francisco to have to go undefeated the rest of the season. So that's the pressure you want to put on the other team. And I'm not even saying that they're going to go 2-3 to end the season. I'm just saying, in theory, you want to put yourself in a position where 11-5 or 11-2 going into the last three games of the season puts you in a position where you're going to have a great chance to either end up at worst as the 2 or 3 seed, but likely you're going to end up as the 1 or 2 seed. Because I think, you know, Philly has Dallas this week. That's a good matchup for Arizona, because they have the tiebreaker over both, and you kind of want those teams to eat themselves out of that 1-2 spot. I don't know if anybody in the North is going to catch Green Bay at this point. So, like you pointed out, they have to kind of, after this week, Green Bay is going to end up at best 12-4. I'm not chalking up a loss to Green Bay. Green Bay fans, if you end up on this podcast somehow, but yeah, you're going against a team that's on fire right now. So, you know, like I said, 11 wins, the next 2 weeks with wins puts a lot more pressure on everybody else than it does Arizona. And that's where you want to be going into that last 3 weeks, where you have a short week against St. Louis, and then you have a probable desperate Seattle and San Francisco teams. So I think these next two games become very important in terms of seeding, as opposed to, because we're not even going to discuss the probability of anything, you know, bad happening here.
Well, it seems, I mean, before we let this even talk about the scenario, I mean, if they lose in Atlanta, then we can start. I think that's the moment we can actually open that conversation. But, you know, losing only their second game of the season and to do so with a bunch of backups at the defending champs in Seattle, you really can't. I mean, big picture, the only two losses they have were to last year's two Super Bowl teams on the road. So I can't really complain very much. I'm looking at the schedule, like you said, that 11-2, putting themselves at 11-2 really almost seals the deal, because you would have a hard time. I mean, it certainly is possible, but at 11-2, based on the Cardinals season, you really can't look at them and say, oh, they're going to lose all three of those games. Certainly, because they are division, they're very losable games, but you just can't picture, oh, I'm going to predict three straight losses. You just really can't do that. And so if they get the 11-2 mark, and with those 11 wins, basically you assume they will win one of those last three, giving them 12. And if they get to 12 wins, it will force Green Bay from this point out to have to win out. They couldn't lose another game, period, to leapfrog them. So that it essentially locks them. I mean, if they get to 12 wins, they will have the number one seed.
Yeah, and then, because that's of where that you conference want to be. Record. Yeah, that's where you want to be. You want, like I said, even at 11-2, that puts pressure on, you know, everybody else to play basically perfect the rest of the way. And again, this is assuming that Green Bay loses this week and you get that two-game advantage back after this week. So you look at it, I think that's where you want to be. This week it's one of those games where you look at it, you really should feel like you can mark this up as a victory, but it again, you're in a weird situation with a desperate team at home that's somehow at 4-7 leading their division. And as weird as it sounds, if they win that game and get to 5-7, you know, they're probably the front runners in their division to win the division. So now all of a sudden, you know, you're playing a similar version scenario as you were last week, just against a team that's not as talented. So, but desperate teams do desperate things, and we saw it last year with the Cardinals, where when you're desperate, you can sometimes you play really good football, and that's what I think that's the one worry you have this week, outside of the fact that you would really like to see the running game get started.
So let's look ahead to this Atlanta game. And again, Cardinals fans, normally I would have a preview podcast. Normally, I would have a guest from one of our SB Nation blogs. I would talk to someone from Alcoholic. However, with the holiday, Thanksgiving and everything, that's not going to be a possibility. So this will be our one show for the week. So we're going to do a little bit of previewing of the game against Atlanta. That's why I am not too terribly worried. Yes, you've got a team that's desperate. The the one thing I say, how desperate they're 4-7. How desperate are they really? Because it's kind of a joke, that whole NFC South, and the fact that they're 4-0 against their division and 0-7 against everyone else. It's not to take them lightly. I just don't think that I don't think they're good enough. They're not good defensively. I mean, they don't run the ball well to begin with, and Matt Ryan historically terrible against the Cardinals. The only reason that they got away years ago is simply because the Cardinals were playing terrible. I mean, they had Ryan Lindley, a quarterback, and at the end of the game, they even had a chance for it, and Larry Fitzgerald dropped a pass. It was a very tough pass. Dropped what a catch that he normally would do and would put and put the Cardinals and kept the Cardinals out of position to win that game. So I'm not too worried about this game, especially since they are not the physical juggernaut that a lot of the other teams they have to face, especially in the division. What does worry me a little bit is that ball hawking secondary, that they've been able to get interceptions. And Drew Stanton so far has, after being very careful with the ball, has shown to be not want to come off his original read and has been turnover prone. If you had to look at this matchup, where do you see the Cardinals matching up well with, and where do you see them not matching up well at all?
They match up well in the scenarios of their strength is the Dolphins' strength, which is they have a great secondary to match up with Atlanta's passing attack. Atlanta does not have a good tight end. So, again, another week where you're not having to worry about the tight end, much like last week. And then it comes down to how, I don't want to say bad, but how bad the Falcons' running game is in terms of just in general. And now you're going up against what probably is the best run defense in the NFL. Matt Ryan's not going to be a guy that makes plays with his legs, so things are going to be okay in that scenario. I think, like you, the one thing you have to worry about, we talked about it at the beginning of the show. It's been 105 long minutes since the Cardinals scored a touchdown. So that's where a concern for me comes in. Even as bad as the Falcons' defense has been, the Cardinals' offense the last seven quarters has probably been worse. So you want to see that change, and you want to see the offense find a rhythm similar to what they did at the beginning of the Detroit game and be able to maintain a rhythm throughout the game. Because now all of a sudden, while these games, the win losses, those things all matter in the scope of the season, especially for seeding, as we just got done talking about, you want to see performances that give you faith going into the playoffs with this team. You want to look at this team and say to yourself, this is a team that can go in and has a good enough offense to make plays. And right now, I personally have a question of whether or not this offense can get on track and be consistent enough to be a force in the playoffs. And that's more important to me than just, oh, hey, we ended up with the one seed. Let's celebrate that. Because if you end up with the one seed, but then get bounced in the first round, it wasn't as successful as the season as it should have been, at least in my eyes, because that's how I kind of view things. Is, yeah, we opened the season as wanting to make the playoffs, but now you're at 9-2, and you've been the best team in the league for 11 weeks. I want to see you be a Super Bowl contender, not a one and done.
Very true. Very true. I like the fact that this week's game features a team in the Falcons that really is not good in the pass rush. It shouldn't. That Drew Stanton should have time to throw, which means he should be able to calm down, not rush his throws, not lock on. I like the fact that the Cardinals have been blitzed. They've been getting to the quarterback really well. they continue to do that. I mean, we've seen what Matt Ryan said. Matt Ryan's had a fantastic career, but against the Cardinals, he's terrible. I mean, it's really weird how terrible he looks. So I'm looking forward to this game. I like the next two games and the fact that the Falcons seem like that should be a win. And then I like it at home against the Chiefs, the fact that the Chiefs' strengths play into what the Cardinals do really well. Cardinals stop running backs, and guess what? That's really all that the Chiefs have to offer is their running backs. And if they can't do that, your Alex Smith is not going to beat you with his arm, really. And the Cardinals have the defensive backfield to stop it anyway. So, yeah, I really like that, especially at home. We should be looking 11-2. So hopefully it is. And plus, this is the perfect game with Atlanta where you can kind of get the running game healthy because Atlanta's defense has been so atrocious against the run. So we should see some open lanes. We should see, hopefully, I mean, we should see Andre Ellington have some open plays, have some plays bust. And we should see Michael Bush, you know, push the pile, not to get 2 yards, but maybe 4 and 5 yards on some of those instead of averaging 1 and 2 and those negative plays the Cardinals have been getting.
Yeah, and I think you want to see some success in a lot of different situations this week. Because like you said, that this is probably the worst team. No, I don't think. This is the worst team that they're going to be playing the rest of the season. I mean, you look at what the Rams did this weekend against the Chargers, and you know they almost beat a good Chargers team that week to week is beginning to look like one of the better wins on the Cardinals' resume. So the Rams are a good team, and you get them on that weird short week in St. Louis, and you've seen all season long how dangerous those games are for the better team, usually, how that hasn't worked out well. So it's just one of those situations where, like I said, get the win this week, get your offense going against a bad defense, take advantage of the home crowd next week, and, you know, things like what was announced about Eric Berry today have a weird way of rallying people. So, you know, I think it's going to be slightly harder game than it would have been had everything been okay. But I still don't see a reason why the Cardinals would lose that game. And then figure it out the last three games where you've got 11 wins already and you've got some room. So,
well, Arizona Cardinals fans, that'll wrap up our show tonight. We've talked Michael Bush and the signing that we talked recapping the loss to the Seattle Seahawks, and we looked ahead to the playoffs and to the matchup this weekend. Arizona Cardinals fans, you won't hear from us until next week. Hopefully, it'll be a 10-2 Cardinals team following a victory in Atlanta. That's Seth Cox. I'm Jess Root. Thank you for listening. Make sure that you go to RevengeOfTheBirds.com if you're not already a member of the community. Join the community. Enjoy the best Arizona Cardinals community that you can find on the web. Find us on Facebook, find us on Twitter. And this show, you can also subscribe on iTunes and on Stitcher Radio. Thanks for listening, as always. And we will hear from you, and you will hear from us, rather, and we will talk to you after the holidays.
You've
been listening to Revenge of the Birds. Keep the conversation going by visiting RevengeOfTheBirds.com. Follow us on Twitter at Revenge of Birds. You can also find us on iTunes at Facebook.com/Revenge of the Birds.
Everyone has a story to tell. Take Jen. She can see all the films she wants, whenever she wants, at Cineworld. From Finding Dory and the BFG to Suicide Squad. She gets 10% off all her cinema snacks, Baskin-Robbins, sweets and treats, you name it. Plus 25% off at some of her favourite restaurants, like Frankie and Benny's. That's Jen's unlimited story. Start yours today when you join Cineworld Unlimited. From just $17.40 a month. Love cinema? Join the club. Sign up today at your local Cineworld or visit cineworld.com.